This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Listening to Buy the Book, I'm Lee Chwee Lin, and with me as always is my fellow sailor on the sea of words, my co-host, Sharmila Ganesan.
It's better every week.
I know. It's better and worse simultaneously. That's what we do here. And today we are actually going to be speaking with John Conley, who is a New York Times bestselling author who has written in a variety of different styles, but in one in particular, which is what we're going to be focusing on, at least at the top. John, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. I feel, do I need to be on a literary boat? You
know? With us, adrift somewhere.
Yeah, with the sail of poetry attached.
Well, on that note, I think the best place to start would be perhaps where you've chosen to sail your particular boat.
We really are working this metaphor,
aren't
we?
We're going to do it to death.
I think it has reached it now. It's
we'll stop now. So you've dabbled in a variety of genres, but I think...
Dabbled? How dare you? I'm leaving now. I should take my dabbling elsewhere.
But, well, you have excelled in a variety of genres, but crime fiction is really the field that you keep coming back to.
Sure, yes. Why
is that?
I think most writers begin with writing what they love. And as a reader, I began with supernatural fiction and mystery fiction. They were the two genres I can remember reading when I was younger. And when I sat down to write, it just seemed natural to me to begin writing in that form. I was comfortable with it. And in a weird way, it was a way of not being an Irish writer. Because I grew up in Ireland at a time when we were poor. It was this island isolated on the edge of Western Europe. It had religious conflict. We had this dreadful history, complicated history with England. And to be an Irish writer was to be engaged with the nature of Irishness. And I remember thinking in my 20s, there are few things I want to engage with less than the nature of Irishness. And so we hadn't written a lot of genre fiction in the 20th century. In the 19th century, our genre was fantasy literature and great Gothic literature. But in the 20th century, we kind of abandoned genre fiction almost entirely. In part, I think, because we're a young country and we were trying to establish an identity, and genre fiction wasn't considered important enough for it. But also because it was very hard to write mystery fiction. You know, when you have a great blooming of mystery fiction in England and America in the 80s and the early 90s, we had what we call the Troubles, the terrorist problems in Northern Ireland. And it's very hard to write ordinary crime fiction when up the road people are engaged in this dreadful conflict and where so much crime arises out of it. And so for me to write about America, to write mystery fiction, was a reaction against all of that. It was a way of escape.
And with that said, though, I mean, I think when we think of genre, such as it is, there are, I suppose, there are pros and cons with being associated with being a genre writer. On the one hand, of course, it's perhaps a little easier to understand or access what it is that this book might be about. People know what they're in for. On the flip side of that, you have, I suppose, the very old, I don't know if it's still happening, that kind of juxtaposition between the genre writer on the one hand and the literary writer on the other. So with that said, I guess, how do you feel about working as a genre writer? Do you find that those trappings or those benefits still remain?
I think the snobbery will always remain. And there's always going to be a tension between commercial and critical success. And every writer finds a place on those two axes to compromise. On the other hand, all fiction has genre in its DNA. That differentiation we make between genre fiction and literary fiction is actually really a product of the last century. And, you know, it's very hard to think of a great American novel that doesn't have a crime in it, for example. You know, we all have a little bit of in our DNA. So I've never felt it was restrictive. And I've always just thought genre is another tool in the writer's armory. So whether you choose to use crime fiction, horror, fantasy, it's how you use it that matters. The difficulty for me is because I've written in different genres, like I said, I view it as a tool, but I've also written literary fiction. the traffic is all in one direction. It is from literary fiction to genre, and primarily it's from literary fiction to mystery fiction, because mystery fiction and detective fiction has a kind of literary and intellectual respectability to it. So when literary writers choose to experiment overtly with genre, they tend to go for detective fiction. There is almost no traffic in the other direction. So I wrote a book called He, which is an unashamed piece of literary fiction. And as a genre writer, you will always be a dog walking on its hind legs, because you just go back to doing whatever you do, because I know you will eventually. And also, there's a kind of belief that you couldn't possibly be bringing anything worthwhile to literary fiction. You know, a literary writer moving into genre will elevate it because of his or her gifts. But the same perception doesn't go in the other direction. And you just have to accept that that's part of the territory. And particularly in Ireland, curiously enough, because we, like I said, we didn't do genre fiction for a very long time. And so critically, we still lag a little bit behind France or Spain, for example, or even the United States and Britain.
So when you do write, whether it's in crime fiction or whether it's in anything else, where do you draw your inspiration from? Who influences you?
That's a very good question. I suspect most writers don't entirely know. It isn't a kind of cause and effect in that way. Writers are very magpie-ish by nature and are always looking for shiny things that attract them and storing them away in our little box of things. And also, ideas aren't the currency for writers. Time is the currency. There's that lovely line from Alice in Wonderland, you know, where the Queen of Hearts says she can think of whatever it is, five impossible things before breakfast. Writing is a little bit like that. You'll have more ideas than you can ever use. And what matters is A, listening to the one that's shouting loudest and then persisting with it. Because I don't know, some of your readers, I often find that people who are interested in reading are often people who are trying to write as well. You know, every book I've written, every book I've published, I've wanted to throw it away after 20,000 words, every single one of them. Because you begin a new project, whether it's an essay or a poem or a short story or a novel, with enthusiasm. It's something new. It's like a new relationship. You think, this is the one. This is the one that's going to change everything. All the others were terrible. And then you start and it's wonderful and it's all passion and flowers and it's running through the hedgerows together. And then, you know, kind of a couple of months into it, you go, God, this is just like the last relationship. You know, maybe I better dump this one as well. It's a little bit like that with writing. You begin new projects with enthusiasm, the enthusiasm wanes a little bit. And when you're trying to write, you'll hear a little voice in your head going, that wasn't a very good idea, was it? Maybe you shouldn't have started that one, but here's a shiny new idea to start. And so people who are trying to write often don't realise that doubt is part of the process, that all writers experience that doubt. And the best piece of advice I've ever read was from Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury, a science fiction author, said that professionals are amateurs who finish things. And what you have to try and learn to do is from the moment you write the first line of your poem or your essay or your short story or your novel, psychologically, you have to commit to writing the last line. You just have to, because otherwise you will set a pattern for abandoning projects and you will end up, as many people who have tried to write will find, with a drawer filled with fragments. And the more often you abandon something, the more you chip away at your creative confidence. And we're all creative individuals to some degree, but you're born with a finite amount of creative confidence. And every time you abandon a project, you will chip a tiny piece of that confidence away and you will never get it back again. So it has to be used very, very carefully. I can't even remember what the question was, but it was a really good one. And I like to think the answer, if not the answer to that question, was the answer to another equally good question.
The answer was a good answer.
Oh, thank you very much.
You know, it works itself out. And, you know, you might feel that way about the books that you are in the process of writing, but you have finished books. You have published books. And perhaps you are best known for your Charlie Parker novels, and the latest of which is Book of Bones. And what is it about? You know, is it a culmination
of anything?
Do I get
to use the word, it's about 700 pages. Was another lovely Bob Dylan answer. What's Blonde on Blonde about? And he said, it's about 60 minutes. It is the culmination of, what I've always tried to do is to write novels that people, if you're fresh to the series, you can read at any point. But if you're reading the books in order, you're getting pieces of a larger puzzle. And I think that's very true of mystery fiction. One of the attractions for any mystery fiction is character. All good fiction is about character. People sometimes think that genre fiction is about plot. All good fiction comes out of character. And one of the pleasures of reading mystery fiction, I think, is that you can get to revisit the lives of these characters year after year after year. You follow them as they get older. You know, you bring, the reader brings a kind of richness to each book from that experience. And so for that reason, I've never felt that, to go back to the question you were asking earlier, I've never felt that genre fiction was a limitation in that way. In some ways, I've often wondered why literary writers don't more often use that structure, because literary fiction seems very resistant to returning to characters over and over. Updike does it a little bit, Philip Roth, Richard Ford with the Frank Bascom novels. But it's the exception rather than the rule. And yet it offers such creative possibilities to writers. And I just wonder why literary writers don't use it more.
So in Bag of Bones specifically, it seems like you're bringing in threads that you have sort of built over many books. Do you have a sort of end point in mind?
If I'm a sensible middle-aged man and I go to the doctor once a year, and if he said, you know, don't book any holidays after next April, I would be able to give the books a conclusion. I know where they're going in the long term. The thing is, I still like writing these books. I still enjoy writing about these characters. And thankfully, I have readers who still enjoy spending time with them. It is a bit of a set of golden handcuffs, though, because I don't think, rarely does a book signing go by without a reader. And it's usually a woman coming up to me and going, you know, I'd be really unhappy if something happened to these characters. And she'll have a death stare on her, you know. And you kind of suddenly see yourself in somebody's basement with your ankles broken while she stands over you going, write the book I want. And so it's a weird thing, you know. You create these characters and then readers take possession of them. And they suddenly stop. Some of your freedom to maneuver can be limited. You have to. I interviewed James Lee Burke many years ago, who was a big influence on me. And Burke said, you have to learn to ignore both the catcalls and the applause. And it's a very, very good piece of advice. We're not running a democracy here. You know, this is my world. You're welcome to visit.
We're speaking today with author John Connolly. If you have any thoughts, if you enjoy, in particular, John's books, let us know. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. And if you have something longer to say, write us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Saw a girl, she was taking a walk. She was looking around for someone else. She was hiding from everything, even scared of her own reflection.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. Today joining us in the studio is John Connolly. And earlier we were talking about Charlie Parker, really. And you were talking about how in some cases you live in fear, perhaps, of, you know, some people demanding certain things because they've gotten used to the character. And I'm just wondering whether, has your knowledge of Charlie Parker changed or deepened over time? You know, you've been writing this one character for a while now. Did you know everything about him when you started, or has that relationship developed?
No, when you begin writing a novel, you kind of hope that you're going to be published, but you suspect that the odds are against it. And what usually happens is a publisher says, no, I'd like to publish it. And your instinct is, well, can I have it back and I'll do it properly? And so you put everything that you know into your first novel, because you kind of don't think you're ever going to get the chance to do it again. And then you have to live with what you put into the book. And so in that first book, I was 25 when I started writing my first novel, and I'm 51 now. And Parker was in his early 30s. He's now kind of more or less in his late 40s, early 50s. So just as my concerns have changed, so too have his. And by letting him grow older, I hope the novels have deepened a little bit, because the easy option is always to keep your characters kind of young and vibrant, and they can kick down doors and they can run away and they have strength and they have agency. By letting them grow older, the nature of the novels changes. And I hope in that way they're kept fresh. They certainly keep, you know, I'm still interested in writing them because I get to explore my concerns. And another of the misconceptions about mystery fiction or genre fiction in general is that it somehow is entirely divorced from the real world. But I interviewed a young science fiction writer for the Irish Times about a month ago. I don't do author interviews very often anymore. It has to be somebody I really kind of am engaged by. Our name was Becky Chambers, and she is a young gay novelist using science fiction to explore issues of gender and sexuality, which are just so important at the moment. But she was using genre in this very, very interesting way. And it's a carrier. Genre is often a carrier, and you can often do things with genre that perhaps you can't do with nonfiction or with literary fiction, because you can sneak a lot of stuff in under the wire under the guise of entertainment. So in that sense, I've never felt restricted by Parker or not particularly by the expectations of readers. I find it's like a skeleton, and you can then hang whatever you want on the skeleton, and you can change its appearance, you know, and you can make it different each time. But you have this structure in a way that readers are familiar and comfortable with. And that familiarity and comfort allows the writer to experiment.
Mm. And your books, they are also, you know, they're set both in the US and the UK. You divide your time between these places as well. How do you decide where which story is going to be set? And does the location help inform the story or vice versa?
Within mystery fiction, landscape is really important. If you think about it, we often associate detectives with the cities or the states right. through which they move. And I often think it's one of the reasons why, for a while, Scandinavian crime fiction was very, very, you know, popular, even with people who'd never been there. You know, people in England were flying to Playa del Inglés or whatever for their Watney's Red Barrel holidays with their all-I-can-eat buffets every day. And they weren't bringing books set on the Spanish resorts. They were bringing these books set in icy Scandinavia, because there was something about these very quite violent, frequently quite violent novels being set in this very ordered 21st century modern society. Yet these cities are also set against these very hostile landscapes, because if you go out in winter in these areas, it's, you know, it's very difficult. It's a difficult environment. So you've got a kind of resonance. And if you get the physical landscape right and you achieve something extra, you get a third component. So I'm often thinking in terms of landscape. And for A Book of Bones, I became interested in psychogeography. And psychogeography is that idea that I suppose human beings leave marks on the landscape. And they're not just physical. They can be psychological, but they can be to do with memory. But also that idea is that successive, you know, if places are habitation, sites of habitation for a long time, you get these ruins. You get older buildings being built on the remains. And people in Malaysia will understand this deeply. You know, you've got this very modern city of Kuala Lumpur. Yet if you go around, you can see these older shop houses. You can get the sense that, you know, there are people living here 100, 200, whatever, many years ago. So for A Book of Bones, I was really anxious to explore that, but you couldn't do it in the United States, because you would only have Native American settlements and then the arrival of the Pilgrim Fathers. Whereas in England, you had, you know, you had the Vikings, you had the Romans, you had the Anglo-Saxons, and you have different layers of religious belief, you know, from pagans through early Christianity, you've got the Roman gods. So there were all these possibilities there that I just didn't have elsewhere.
We are living in a time where there is this fascination with true crime. We're seeing this come through, whether it's in documentaries, TV series, even podcasts. People are just utterly fascinated by, in some ways, exactly what you were just talking about, the idea that there were lives here before, that there was violence here before. Mm. And has this public fascination and also the sudden increase in terms of media output covering these things changed your approach to writing crime fiction at all?
No, it's funny. There are people who will watch true crime series and read true crime books who have no interest in reading crime fiction. It's almost a different fascination. It's that kind of idea of the monsters within us, these people living in our society. And we have a kind of ghoulish fascination with those extremities. The strange thing is, there are things that people do in real life that I wouldn't put in my books, because they would be so appalling, you know, that they would put you off entirely. And as I go on, I become less interested in violence and those kind of extremities. What has always interested me was not... criminals, by and large, are not very interesting. You know, they're criminals because they can't hold down a proper job. And the more monstrous individuals have really very little to do with us as human beings. They are so extreme. What has always interested me is how do good people cope when there is this kind of intrusion of evil into their lives? How do they continue? And also why it's so important, particularly in the age that we're living in, for good people not to feel overwhelmed by the evil in the world. Because we look around and we just see people, you know, we live in a world of extremes. We've seen, particularly in Europe at the moment and in the United States, this rise of the extreme right again. And sometimes kindness and decency seem to be in very, very short supply. And it's easy to become disheartened. I have two sons who sometimes feel that the world is coming to an end. And what you have to say is that you can't allow that kind of pessimism to seep in. What is important is that good people continue to try and strive to be good. In my mystery novels, there's always hope. The writer Edmund Burke said that all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to stand by and do nothing. In my novels, Parker and those around him refuse to stand by, because if you stand by, you become complicit. So maybe what interests me and what crime fiction allows me to explore is not necessarily the same themes that fascinate people in true crime.
I'm curious to know also about your, I suppose, definition, for lack of a better word, of evil, because that's an interesting one, and it's an especially interesting one in the context of crime, especially crime that has elements of supernatural and horror mixed into it. So as a writer, how do you sort of understand the term, and has it changed over the years?
I guess there are gradations of it. My understanding is that most human beings are not evil. We do evil acts, but we do it often because we're frightened or we're angry or we're whatever it might be. And out of that, as a consequence, people can do the most terrible things and justify them to themselves. Very, very occasionally, we will encounter acts that are so extreme and so extraordinary that we find it difficult to accept that a human being is capable of them. And I was born Catholic. You know, I'm a terrible Catholic. I'm a Christmas Day Catholic. But you can't entirely shake off that belief system, and nor would I want to. And the Parker novel suggests that at that point, perhaps human beings are capable of drawing on a much older atavistic well of evil. And that's the one that we have. And that's the evil that we give. You know, if you come from a Judeo-Christian background, it's whatever you may call it, the devil, you may call it, you know, hell, whatever it might be. And potentially that's what we can draw on. And that's just an interesting philosophical avenue to explore. For the most part, though, I just look around and think evil is an absence of empathy. It's the absence, that willingness to understand that other people suffer just as you do, and they shouldn't be permitted to suffer. That in all cases, you should try to do what you can to stop it, not cause it. But like I said, at the extremes, you have something that baffles all of us. And yeah, and I get to explore that through my books, but only because they have that slight supernatural element to it. You know, that allows me to explore that element, I think.
So to step away a little bit from the mystery crime genre, you have written many other things, and you've written in a variety of spaces as well. You've done the Samuel Johnson series, which is for younger readers. You've done fantasy, the Book of Lost Things. You've done a sort of fictional exploration of Stan Laurel, which you mentioned earlier. Do you see yourself doing more works like these, and what else are you interested in exploring?
Yeah, you know, it's even much as I love mystery fiction, you sometimes need to step out of it to develop a new skill. And then that skill I can then apply to the Parker novels and move those along. So I had two piles of books on my office floor for a very long time. One of them related to Stan Laurel. And I thought at some point either my office floor is going to collapse or I'm going to have to write this book. And there was another pile of books related to a different historical period. So that may, when that voice starts calling loudly enough, that's the one that I will explore. But you never know where inspiration is going to strike. I was asked last year to write, if I wanted to write a book about a film that I'd loved. And I ended up picking a very obscure horror film called Horror Express, made in the 70s. But the book then became an exploration of nostalgia. And suddenly what should have taken me about 2 weeks to write took 6 months. but it was worth it. So, you know, I never quite know where things are going to go. I'm very fortunate that I have a very tolerant set of publishers and a very tolerant readership. You know, the people who read the Parker novels don't necessarily go on and read the other things. But enough of them do that they allow me to continue. So I've had the 20 years I've had have been very fulfilling creatively, I have to say. I have the career I would have liked to have right at the start. And mainly that's down to the readers.
And on that rather lovely note, John, thank you so much for joining us
today. It's
been
a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with John Connolly. If you have any thoughts that you'd like to send over, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. Brings us to footnotes, as it always does. So we thought that having spoken to somebody who is maybe best known, although he doesn't only work in it, but he's best known for writing in sort of that crime thriller genre, mm-hmm. we thought we'd talk about it from the point of view of being readers of that, right? And do you particularly like reading genre, particularly this?
As in the crime thriller genre, I go through phases. I definitely go through phases where I've enjoyed the pleasure of it. So, for instance, Stieg Larsson, the Millennium trilogy. Is it still a trilogy? Yes, it is. Although there'd been adjacent books. I love Michael Crichton, who isn't a sort of a crime thriller, but he's very genre. Mm. So I realize a lot of the writers that I've liked over the years are actually genre writers. Stephen King, definitely. I've talked about him so many times. I never realized they were genre writers when I got into them, though.
So, again, as you said, right, similar to the way we've talked about Stephen King, I've also talked about my particular pathway to reading adult books. And one of the people that was actually along that road that I don't bring up often enough, I think, is John Grisham.
I want to start by telling you that Bendini, Lambert & Locke is a small firm, 41 lawyers and all. But I prefer to think of us as a family. And like most families, loyalty is what we value more than just about anything. Now, the letter you got from us was the only one sent out. Because you're the only one we want. You should also know that many of our partners are millionaires by the time they're 45. Our offer includes a bonus schedule, a low-interest mortgage for the purchase of a new home, and the lease of a new Mercedes. Your wife can choose the color. We have faith that you're going to be with us for a long, long time, Mitch. Fact is, nobody has ever left us. Nobody.
And he's somebody that I just started reading a lot of for a very specific period of time. And I think about that with a real sense of fondness because each book is different, right? Obviously, the stories are different, the characters are different, but they're also not. Mm-hmm. Because you know there's going to be a big court scene. You know that there's going to be a lawyer who maybe decides that, hey, working within the confines of the law, not enough. I need to start pushing boundaries. You know that there are very specific highs and lows that you can expect to hit in the book. And I think that that is actually the particular thing about reading genre. I get sick of it after a time, I'm not going to lie, but there's usually a period, you know, every year over a period of a month or so, suddenly I just can't get enough of a certain type of world, a certain type of space.
And there's a reason for that, right? I mean, there's joy in familiarity, there's comfort in familiarity, comfort in knowing that there is a certain arc. We know it's coming. We might not know exactly when, but it happens. And then you're kind of like trying to figure out whether the way you thought this mystery was going to be resolved was the way it's going to happen. I used to love that about is Thomas Harris's genre, right?
I would say so, yeah.
So Silence of the Lambs and on. Again, very inventive stories, but he does stay within the genre of that serial killer format. But then he does it so well. So I've never understood that idea of dividing and deciding that certain writers, just because they choose to write within the confines of a genre, were any less than the so-called literary writers. And John Connolly alludes to this as well in his interview, where he doesn't actually believe in these demarcations at all. And I think rightfully so.
Some of it is just marketing, though, because while we're speaking about the crime thriller genre, I can see the covers of the books. They're usually dark. Mm-hmm. The author's name or the title of the book is in grey, gold, or red.
Yeah.
Those are the options.
So if you tell me John Grisham, I can imagine a cover in my head, you know, like the shadows, the familiar font of his name.
Correct. I was going to say, I think he uses the same font, you know, throughout every single paperback. And conversely, you have what you would call chick lit.
Rebecca Bloomwood. Dress, Zac Posen. Belt, Todd Oldham Vintage. Bag, Gucci. You know that thing when you see someone cute and he smiles and your heart kind of goes like warm butter sliding down hot toast? Well, that's what it's like when I see a store
which is frothy. Every cover is you know, lightly colored pastel.
Their shopping bags or shoes or shop windows.
Scarves. Yeah. I'm thinking here of the Sophie Kinsella's, you know.
Shopaholic.
Exactly. And so I wonder how much of it has to do also with the way books are marketed. Because the thing about genre and the reason why these writers tend to be the ones on the bestsellers list is because people like that familiarity, right? So they go back for it. And there is no risk involved in picking up the new Sophie Kinsella, the new John Grisham, because you know the quality is there. The story is just a question of how fresh it's managed to become.
The expected quality, I would argue.
Yes, that's fair. An important word. But yeah, so because of that, I think there is a very good argument to be made for let's just keep marketing it exactly the same way. And if you have a new author coming up in this vein, then you know what? We know what works. Let's just bundle it together. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the genre experience as well.
I also wonder how much it has to do with the fact that the one thing a lot of these genre writers share in common is how prolific they are.
Yeah.
You know, they are able to continue using that format. And perhaps it's because they already have that format. So they can kind of play around within that box, but come up with new things.
Mad libs.
Without minimizing what they do, right?
Yes.
Whereas like a literary writer may feel compelled to consistently come up with utterly new sort of storylines and characters, the genre writers are not sort of held to that. And so then the being prolific helps with the marketing as well, no? Because for writers, they have that pleasure that, oh, every Christmas I can get my husband a John Grisham book. And that's something quite nice about that.
Yes. I think there is a discussion that we probably need to have in a longer format about the whole idea of the literary writer continuing to push boundaries. Because I think in some ways that is it's not a genre, it's a style, right? More often than not, it's a style. And I'm thinking here of someone like Murakami, who has a very specific language, very specific, often characters and stories, you know, all these stories about isolation and like, they're very specific to him. You know also what to expect. What makes you different then from
to the
someone?
Point of becoming a genre unto himself.
Is how it feels sometimes. But that's just us. And, you know, that's probably something that requires a bit more examination. But let us know, are you a genre reader? Are you somebody who, you know, tends to kind of pick up books from the same author in the same style? Is it something you enjoy? Tell us why, or tell us why not, for that matter. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. We have been getting letters, I'm not shy to say. So if you would like to join our email box, you can write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.